Yes.
Cool. So last week was the actual war, right? Between Avshalom's forces and David's forces. And we saw the Navi really set up, not interestingly, a contrast between David and Avshalom, but the contrast really was between Yoav and Avshalom. Avshalom, who is the bloodthirsty one. Avshalom is the one who wants to kill everybody. Avshalom is the one who's riding around on a fancy mule, so he can't actually fight while asking other people to do his dirty work for him. And Yoav was the general who was very focused. He had the exact same strategy as Achitofel, just on the opposite side, where he just wants to kill the one leader of the rebellion, and then he knows that's going to be the end of the war. He blows the shofar as soon as he's killed Avshalom. I think it was Abarbanel who pointed out that it's not very easy to get a victorious army, especially one as dedicated and as angry as David's must have been, to stop the chase exactly at the moment that they won. But that's exactly what Yoav does. He blows the shofar the second to three times he's going to do that. He ends the war, right? He ignores the command of David. He realizes that Avshalom needs to be killed, and the Navi just saw, and he does it himself, right? The way that the Malbim and the Abarbanel read that conversation, Ish, as he said, right, "Lo kein ochila fanacha," you're wrong, and I'm going to start in front of you. So Avshalom, who always has his servants, killing Amnon or burning Yoav's field or fighting for him in this battle, Yoav does things himself. He's absolutely focused, and the Navi really seems to strongly endorse him. But what's really interesting is that David HaMelech did not appear at all in the whole battle, right? There, the Navi seemed to once again link the battle here with the experience and the career of Yehoshua, when the Navi described how there were more enemies who were killed by the animals or killed in the forest than were killed in the battle. It sounded just like Yehoshua's fight against the Canaanim in the south. Except Yehoshua is the one who leads the battle there, of course, right? And he's the one, Shemesh v'Gavon Dom, v'Yareach v'Ayalon. And here, David is in the background. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to finish Perek Yudches, and hopefully we'll do all of Perek Yudches, because we'll see, I think, that it really should go together. The way that they divided up the Prakim when they did it was they have the battle until David is informed of Avshalom being killed. That's Perek Yudches. And then they have Perek Yudches as David's reaction. But I think we'll see that really the better way to break this up, I think, is the battle leading up to the death of Avshalom. And now things shift from Yoav and Avshalom to Yoav and David. And we'll see David, on the one hand, really blow it at the beginning, but we're gonna see how the Navi then takes a step back and we see, number one, there are two consistently different approaches. We could call it, I think we're calling it like the dove and the hawk. The attitude, the general philosophy of Yoav and the philosophy of David. And sometimes the Navi is going to seem to say that Yoav's perspective is the correct one, and sometimes David's is the correct one, all smushed up in these two prakim over here. And in addition, we will once again see David following his MO, which is he does and can make mistakes. There are times that he follows his emotions, and this is going to be one of the most understandable, if not the most understandable example in David's whole career. But again and again, invariably, he finds his way back. He's able to correct course. And when people point out things he's doing wrong, he listens to them and adapts, which sounds really, really easy. But as we know, that is much more easily said than done, especially when you're, the king. Okay, so let's get started with the source sheet. All right, so we last left off with the Navi really having some fun, honestly, at the expense of Avshalom, when the Navi told us how Avshalom wanted to be buried in his Yad Avshalom, the glorious monument, the glorious mausoleum, which Rashi quoted that Avshalom said, "None of my sons are like me, none of my kids are as great as me, so I need a monument to memorialize myself." And that being contrasted with the reality that Avshalom was buried in a pit under a pile of rocks in a forest, the same pile of rocks that those Canaanite kings in Sefer Yehoshua were buried under as well. So now Avshalom is in the rear view mirror, right? And the second for the rest of the parak is the news being broken to David. So we have this Achimat, the son of Tzadok, you know, coming off of his previous career as a spy in Yerushalayim. So now he's going to transfer from being a spy to being a runner, and he's going to bring information. So he wants to tell Yoav what happened right away, as soon as Avshalom was killed. Let me tell him, Arutza l'avavasol malach kishav to Hashem b'yad ayavav. But Yoav, who knows David better than anybody, says, not so fast. The important thing here at the beginning, and the Malbim is going to expand upon this, is that the entire army expects David to be ecstatic. The entire army expects David to rejoice that Avshalom is dead and the rebellion is over. Still surprising, because they all know that Avshalom's orders had been not to kill Avshalom, but still, you know, he was a major threat. It was a disaster. He was responsible for the deaths of thousands of lives and would have been responsible for the deaths of David's entire army. So they expect David to be happy when he hears the news. And Yoav alone knows David. There's nobody in Sefer Shmuel who knows David HaMelech better than Yoav ben Tzruya. There's probably nobody who knows Yoav ben Tzruya better than David HaMelech. So Yoav knows that David is not going to be happy. And he says, don't do it. You should not tell him that the son of the king is dead, right? You see, Achimat describes Avshalom as the enemy, right, the Oyev. And Yoav describes Avshalom as the Ben HaMelech. He's also the son of the king. So Yoav recognizes that things are more complicated. Yoav tells some anonymous Cushi to do it instead. We'll return to the identity of this Cushi in a minute. Right, but long story short, so the Nebi tells us that Achimat really wants to go. So Yoav says, okay, fine. You know, you want to ignore my advice, you can do it. And then the Nebi tells us David is waiting back between the gates. Somebody tells him someone's coming. David is clearly aware. He's not totally out of it. He says, well, if it's one person coming, then he's coming to bring news. That's not a refugee, right? He says, Im levado misara b'fiv. One person running by himself is coming to bring news. He's not a refugee. Okay. Achimatz comes. He realizes he probably shouldn't tell David exactly what happened. And then the Cushi comes, and the Cushi tells him the news. Okay. Now, one thing I want to just extract from the Pesukim over here, and I can go into these in depth because I think we're really more interested in the Pesukim in detail and Perek Yutes. But there's a very clear parallel that Sefer Shmuel draws here between this piece in Sefer Shmuel and a previous piece in Sefer Shmuel, and this does not make David look good. Because we're going to have here in the parak is David is going to place his personal desire above his job as king. He's going to mourn and mourn excessively for Avshalom, as understandable as that may be, and the Navi is clearly going to be critical of his approach. And the first hint we get from this, even before David says anything, right? David's not going to talk. The way the Christians broke up the Prakim, David's not going to say anything until Perek Yutes. But even at the end of Perek Yutes over here, we can't help but notice that this is not the first time in Sefer Shmuel that we have the leader of Bnei Yisrael standing back, waiting by the gate to hear news of the battle. An individual person comes and tells him the news. He takes the news terribly, and he also had the wrong priorities in what he wanted to hear, right? It's a lot of parallels to the very beginning of Sefer Shmuel, Shmuel Aleph, Perek Daled, Eli the Kohen Gadol, the first leader that we see in Sefer Shmuel, the first failed leader that we see in Sefer Shmuel, and him, right, as an ancient, fading 98-year-old man, right, who's blind. It is totally understandable why Eli is not at the battle in Ophek against the Plishtim. But the Navi has a very similar situation, right? A man comes from Binyamin, an unnamed man, right? So he runs by himself to bring news of the battle. Eli is sitting by himself by the gate waiting for the news. When he gets the news, just as David kind of breaks down in one pasuk, so Eli falls backward off of his chair and dies. Now, you do not, in Sefer Shmuel, want to be compared to Eli the Kohen Gadol. Eli the Kohen Gadol was a tzaddik. As a leader, though, he was a total failure, right? And the Navi, by bringing Eli in here, that is a pretty condemning statement to make towards David HaMelech. As a leader, you do not want to resemble Eli HaKohen. It's even worse because in the beginning of the rebellion, the Navi contrasted David with Eli. When David heroically sent the Aron Kodesh back to Yerushalayim, he realized that the Aron was not some box. And he talked about this explicitly in his parak in Tehillim parak Gimel, that David realizes that the Ribono Shel Olam can hear his tefillah, whether the Aron is with him wherever he goes, or whether he's long distance and the Aron is back in Yerushalayim. The Aron is, it's a holy box. At the end of the day, the Aron is a box. It does not represent the Shekhinah itself. That was the insight that David had. Hashem is not limited by some physical utensil. Eli HaKohen, for all of his Yirah Shamayim, had that basic misperspective. Eli was obsessed with the Aron. He wasn't focused on the state of Bnei Yisrael in the battle. He wasn't even focused on the state of his children who were going to battle, right? The Navi says, Ki hayali bo chared al Aron hu Elokim. The only thing that Eli cared about was the box, which in many ways was the least important of all the things that were going to war. You know, the Aron is going to take care of itself. A couple of prakim later, the Aron does take care of himself. Hashem is not going to let the Aron get into too much trouble with the Plishtim. As the leader of Bnei Yisrael, you need to focus on the people and the fact that even though the Aron is with them, Hashem is not with them. And that was the basic mistake that that Eli made. Here, David HaMelech is in the exact same situation. He's looking for news from the battle. One man is coming and giving it to him, and he is also focused on the wrong thing. He should be focused on the battle. He should be focused on his role as the national leader. He's getting news of a victory instead of a calamity, but he's only focused myopically on Avshalom, his son. And there's a place in Chazal, Abarbanel brings this medrash, which I think is really fascinating, where Chazal clearly were drawing on this parallel as well. Because take a look at source number two, the Pirkei, to Rabbi Eliezer over here. Yeah, so Yov said to the Kushi, the anonymous Kushi, Leichagid Lamel. And the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer says, Vichi Kushi Haya, he wasn't a Kushi, he wasn't some ger from Africa. Valo Ben Yamini Haya, he was a man from Shevet Binyamin. There's no indication in the Pasuk that he's from Shevet Binyamin. The Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer just assumes he was from Binyamin. So there's a number of examples of these where you have somebody, this is a Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer is doing over here. You have somebody who's described as a Kushi just in the sense that just like the Kushi stands out in a crowd because his skin is darker than everyone else's. Kaichai ben Yamini, Mishana Maisa, Vudracha Tov Mikol Yisrael. So too, this anonymous person who was running was stood out, right? He was better than everyone from Israel. So what's the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer doing here? So I think there are two things, one for sure, and one speculate a little bit, but also I think, tell me if you agree, but I'm pretty confident this is what Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer was up to. Number one, the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer is seeing a parallel between the person running to David and the Ish Binyamin who runs to Eli. I think that's undeniable. Clearly putting these two people together. Now, this is maybe one step further, but how does the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer know that this Kushi, this anonymous Kushi, was better than everyone else? I should have put this on the source sheet. But who Chazal believe is the anonymous Ish Binyamin? Last year, when we learned Shmuel Aleph, we talked about this. Chazal understand that it's Shaul. And there are a whole bunch of interesting reasons to think that this is Shaul HaMelech. Well, Shaul is somebody who is described, right, as he's Tov, he's better than everyone else in Bnei Yisrael. So possible the Pirkei Eliezer is also seeing a parallel between the young Shaul, who is more Tov than everybody else, and this Kushi. Either way, keeping the focus on David, the Navi is introducing us to him over here as like he's an Eli 2.0. He's not involved in the battle, he's staying behind, and he's just waiting to hear about the wrong news. He's not focused on what he needs to focus on as the leader. Right? You see how this really should be one parallel. David then hears the news, And Pasuk Aleph, one of the most famous Pesukim, definitely in all of Sefer Shmuel, where he mourns, B'ni of Shalom, B'ni of Shalom, Mi Yutein Musi Ani Tachtach of Shalom, B'ni. Right? The Navi is just not hiding from us at all the incredible emotion that that David has. The Malvin points out that something important for us to think about with the psyche of David HaMelech, it is not just the mourning of a father for his son. And it's really fascinating. This is really the first time that we see David's love for Avshalom. It never came through when they were in Yerushalayim. He pointed out, the Malvin himself pointed out, that David was pretty cold, at least externally, to Avshalom in Yerushalayim. But here we see this total rush of emotion that David has. The Malvin points out there is another piece that's driving this, says the Malvin, that David knows that to some degree he himself is responsible for what happened. He knows the prophecy of Nasan. He knows that to some degree this is a punishment for his own sins. It's obviously also a result of the Bechira Chavshis of Avshalom, but he knows that he's also being punished over here. So the Malbim says, that's what David says, Mi tain musiani tachtacha. I wish I had died instead of you. I wish Hashem had punished me by killing me instead of making me see your death. Right. So between his just mourning for his son, which is universally the most bitter possible experience, and his awareness, and he's not wrong that to some degree he is responsible for this, just has David totally thrown off. You know, and as understanding of it as we can be, nonetheless, the Navi is critical. I think it's really, really important and interesting. The Navi does not hide whatsoever. It gives us every piece of the emotion that David has, and that is super understandable. But at the end of the day, when you are the king, and note how the Navi again and again does not refer to him here as David, right? He's the Melech again and again. When you are the Melech, like it or not, being the Melech has a job. We can compare it to the Kohen Gadol. Aaron HaKohen is the Kohen Gadol. And what does Hashem tell him? Nadav and Avihu have been killed, but that can be leadership. Being the Kohen Gadol means that sometimes your role has to transcend your personal emotion, as excruciatingly impossible as that can be. Right? The Kohen Gadol has to be on call at all times. He always needs to be focused on the world of the Mishkan, on the world of the Beis HaMikdash, regardless of what happens to him. The Kohen Gadol never becomes tamei to any of his relatives, right? Everyone else does, every other relative does, every other Kohen does, but the Kohen Gadol, it's a superhuman demand we make of the Kohen Gadol, because like it or not, he has a superhuman job. That's how he's able to go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur. Well, the Melech is parallel to that. The king has to transcend his personal emotions, as incredibly difficult or impossibly difficult as that can be, because his job is to be the leader of B'nai Yisrael. And here, David is not quite up to it. Navi says, so the king is crying and he is mourning for Avshalom. The Malbim again has a very sharp diuk over here. It says, the Malbim says that Yoav knew that David was going to be sad. Right? That's why he told Achimat, I don't want you bringing the news. But what surprises Yoav? So writes the Malbim, Yoav faryadashi is that save a melech al beno. And that's in contrast to the rest of the army, as he's going to say in a minute. Rak chashav shagam yatziv keteva ha'av. He knew that David would be sad, like the nature of a father for a child. However, lo yisabel alav. But he thought that David would be able to restrain himself and not mourn publicly. The Malbim points out that this is a general halachic requirement, by the way. If somebody is executed by the Bezdin, so this is what he compares it to. If someone's executed by the Bezdin, the relatives do not sit shiva, right? They do not have a velus. Now the Gemara says that when one's relative is executed, aninus is there, right? The initial period before the burial that is fulfilled. The Gemara says because aninus is something in stavra shebelev, so that is really fueled by the emotional response, but the mourning isn't there. And the Malbim explains that for Yoav, Yoav says, I can understand David being sad internally, but the public mourning is a disaster, right? So Malbim says, even Yoav, who knew, the rest of the Esau didn't know this, right? The rest of, and the Malbim, and once you see it, the next pasuk, what do the people say? And the next pasuk, all the people are now in mourning, right? Victory is turned to mourning. The people are surprised to hear that the king is sad. See the difference? It's so sharp. Yoav is surprised to hear about the mourning, and the people are surprised to hear about the grief, because the people expected David to be happy. Yoav expected David to be sad, but to not show it. Okay, and then the Navi gives a fantastic description of the scene over here, the image. I wish I could have like put a drawing here. Pasuk Dal, Pasuk Hey. And the Navi says that Vayisganev ha'am b'yom ahu lavo ha'ir. They're like slinking back into the city. Kasher yisganev ha'am ha'nichlamim b'nusam b'melchama. When soldiers lose a battle, right? So each one tries to like slip anonymously back into the city without being seen because of the immense shame that they feel for having lost the battle. You know, on their way out, they're told, you know, return home victorious, or, you know, with your shield or on your shield, right? That's the line. So when they lose and yet they survive and run back, they try to like slip in while no one's noticing, just blend into the crowd. Well, that's happening now, except the people won. And what's happening? Right, the king is covering his face and he's crying out loud of Shalom. The king is on top of the gate. So the image, right? The people are coming back to the city and they are going through the gates. It should be a parade. David should be there. They should be marching through the gates with pride. Everyone should be celebrating. Instead, the people have to walk through the gates while literally seeing and hearing David HaMelech crying and weeping and mourning directly above them. And each one of them tries to like run through and scurry through the gate without being seen. They don't want David to see them. They feel so terrible. They feel so embarrassed. And this is a total, it's a total extremely understandable, but yet at the end of the day, failure of leadership. And then the Navi gives us the confrontation between Yoav and David, which really is some of the most astonishing psukim you're ever going to find. The conversation over here. This is Yoav talking to the king, right? And the Navi does not, again, he's always Hamelach. Even these psukim over here, Vayavoha Yoav el Hamelach Habayis. So, you know, the Dat Mikra, I think, points out that at least this didn't happen in public. You know, Yoav does not have this conversation in front of the whole army. Yoav and the king, they go to the bayis. They go in, they close the door, and now Yoav shows David the respect of closing the door. He's not going to embarrass him in front of his men, but Yoav has three psukim where, I don't know if anybody in the history of kings has ever talked to a king this way. We have to read it all inside. Hovashta hayom es p'nei kol abadacha. You've embarrassed all of your servants. Hamatim es nafshacha hayom, right? And they saved your life. Not only have you embarrassed your servants who saved you, you've embarrassed your sons, your daughters. You've embarrassed your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your pilag shim. And then here is the key line, the absolute money line. Here is the worldview of Yoav in one piece of a pasuk. La'ahava es sonecha, vilisno es ohavecha. David, your behavior is you are loving your enemies and you are despising your friends. The worldview of Yoav is hyper loyalty to your friends. Yoav is certainly independent, but at no point does Yoav ever show a hint of disloyalty to David, right? Avishai as well. Avishai is he's absolutely on the same page as Yoav, right? They're the ones who want to go and kill Shaul. They're the ones who want to go and kill Shimi ben Gera. You know, in many ways, they're more pro-David than David himself is. Hyper loyalty to your friends and absolutely nothing but crushing your enemies. That is the worldview of Yoav. The world, black and white, my friends, my enemies. I am as strong an ally as possible and I am as strong an enemy as possible. You do not want to be on Yoav's bad side, right? If you do, you're going to end up getting the Avner treatment, getting the Avshalom treatment, getting the Moab and Edom and Ammon and Aram treatment. Be on his good side, don't be on his bad side. And Yoav is telling David, you're not behaving that way, and it is a disaster. You're basically declaring that your supporters are nothing. If Avshalom was alive, we'd all be dead. Right? Let's not get romantic. Let's not get nostalgic. Let's look at this clear-eyed and straight and fair and honest and not get your emotions get in the way. At the end of the day, if Avshalom was alive, I'd be dead. Your other servants would be dead. Your sons, your daughters, your wives, your pelekshim. Avshalom wanted to kill everybody who had anything to do with you. And when you mourn him, as understandable as that may be, it is intolerable because it is just a betrayal to everyone else, right? Hovashta hayom, higarata ki ein lecha sarim. And then Pasuk Ches, he's talking to a king. Ve'ata kum tsei v'daber aliv avadach. Three consecutive words that Yoav speaks b'lashon tzivui, right? He's commanding David, get up, get out, and talk to your servants. You know, this isn't a suggestion. It's not a recommendation. There's no please. It's like he's General Yoav is talking to a private in the army. You know, Yoav knows how to give orders, but he's giving orders to a king. Get up, get out, and talk to your servants. Ki vashem nishbati. Then he's, you know, if this will perk up David's ears. Someone mentions the Shem Yudke Vavke, Shem Havaya. So Yoav swears in the name of Hashem. Ki vashem nishbati. You know, and when Avshalom swears in the name of Hashem, you know, he does that. That's false. When Yoav swears in the name of Hashem, Yoav is deadly serious. Ki eincha yotzei im yalin ish itcha halayla. If you do not go out, you will have nobody by the end of the night. Right? V'ra'al chazos b'kolor asher balacham in racha arata. If you blow this, then this will be a bigger calamity than anything that has ever happened. Abarbanel has a nice line. And, you know, classic Yoav is just a military man. We could imagine Yoav thinking this way. When Yoav said to David, Yedati ki lu chayav shalom b'kolom hayom esim, you know, if Avshalom lived, we would all die. Ki az yashar b'necha, would that be right for you? Let's take a look at the Malbush slides over here, right? War is a zero-sum game. One side's going to win, and one side is going to lose. Yoav appreciates that. You know, this isn't diplomacy. There's no gray zone. There's no compromise. There's no peace process over here. Win or lose, live or die. And you may love Avshalom as your son, but you're, right, every ounce that you invest in Avshalom, you are just taking away from everyone else. And you need to see that. You need to recognize that and acknowledge that. And now, David, to his infinite credit, you know, and does something absolutely heroic on many levels, he listens exactly to what Yoav tells him. Right? And you can imagine, this is the man who killed his son. Right? But he hears what Yoav is saying, and he realizes that Yoav is correct. He gets up, and he goes, and he sits in the gate, like he should have been doing originally. So David's side, right, they all march before the king. Now, you know, it's like, run it back. Let's have that parade we were supposed to have the first time. And David transcends his emotions, leaves those on the inside, while externally he looks like the king should be, and he watches the whole army march before him, while Yisrael, that's Avshalom's army, they all run back to their tents. Right. So once again, we have David failing. You know, the emotions get the best of him, but when he gets the musr, and this is the most astonishing one probably, because it's one thing when you get the musr from a Nasan Hanavi. You know, it's the one thing when Gad HaChozeh tells you to do something that you don't want to do. But you listen because Nasan's a Navi. You listen because God is a Navi. Here, it's Yoav. It's his nephew. It's his general. He's not exactly talking with, you know, please and thank you. He's ordering him around. And yet, with all the reasons of, you know, emotionally, professionally, any reason David has, why he could just get angry at Yoav, say, how dare you, blow him off, continue in his mourning. Whenever David gets the message that he's doing something wrong and the message is on point, David listens to it and he changes course. And he has to get immense credit for doing so. Okay, so now that is only the first of really four cases where this worldview clash of David and Yoav comes up, you know, and we'll see the other three now as the parak continues. Okay, how much time do we have? Not so much. So let's just keep going. Okay, so first, right, so now that David won the war, he has to win the peace. And next week, Gemir Hashem, we'll learn the story of Shava ben Bechri and how complicated and difficult that can be. But now David's trying to win the peace. So first, he sends to Yehuda. The men of Yehuda had abandoned David for Avshalom. Remember, this is like the Korach rebellion, where Korach got all the different people who hated each other on his side, you know, united against Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron. So Avshalom pulled off the same thing. He had a coalition of Yehuda and Binyamin and the tribes in the north all united against David, because the tribes in the north were bitter that Yehuda was being favored, and Yehuda was bitter that they felt they were not being favored. So David wants to get Yehuda back on his side. And he says, you're my brothers, you're my flesh and blood. They just betrayed him, but you know, David is being very diplomatic. This is going to blow up in his face because this is just going to alienate the other Shvatim. It's possible that he had no viable solution, but okay. And then in Pasuk Yudal, David says something shocking. He turns to Amasa. Now, Amasa is David's nephew. So when Amasa, when he says, you are my flesh and blood, he is correct. But Amasa was the general of Avshalom, right? That is as intense a betrayal as one could possibly have, where Amasa threw in with his first cousin against his uncle. Let's remember, Avshalom, Amasa, and Yoav are all first cousins, right? They're all, they're all first cousins. So this is a family affair over here. The expectation would be that Amasa should be a dead man. You know, you rebel against the king, you are the general of the army rebelling against the king, you should be dead. If you're extremely lucky, you're going into Gaulis, right? You're running away as far and as fast as you can. What does David say to Amasa? Ko yasele o kim ko yosef, he swears, im lo sar tzavat yelef anai kol heim tachas Yoav. I am firing Yoav, and I am going to make you the general of the army, right? That is incredible. Now, why does David do that? There's a good reason why David might do that. There's a bad reason why David might do that. The bad reason is immediately identified by the Radak. Once again, the phenomenon of the leader putting his personal, emotional response above the national interest. Right? Radak says, "Kisana David as Yoav al shaharagas Avshalom." David despises Yoav because he knows that David killed Avshalom. The Ralbag adds in another piece that David may have been upset at Yoav for how he yelled at him. Okay, so there are emotional reasons why David can want Yoav fired. The one that really, right, the Ralbag, Radak, Avarbanel all identify is the fact that he knows that Yoav killed Avshalom. There's also a political reason to do this, which is Ralbag and Avarbanel both point out, if you want to get Yehuda back on your side, well, being nice to Amasa is a way to get Yehuda back on your side. Amasa is the general, right? He was the general. Shevet Yehuda loves Amasa. He's absolutely a partisan of Yehuda. And so by being forgiving towards Amasa, the hope is he'll be able to get Yehuda back on his side. Right. So going back to the line that Yoav had about, what was the, I just want to get the exact quote because it's just such a good one, I should memorize it, right? La'ava esonacha v'lesno esoavecha. So David is not going in that direction, right? He's not hating his enemy. He's trying to bring his enemy back onto his side. Now, is that the right approach or the wrong approach? With Avshalom, clearly disaster. With Amasa, it is an open-ended question. We'll have to return to this next week, Amir Hashem, when we learn about Yoav's assassination of Amasa. Because Yoav very clearly identifies Amasa as the enemy and says enemies have to be crushed. So David is still following his basic policy of trying to be conciliatory towards enemies. In this case, we'll see the results are complicated. Same exact thing happens as the parak continues. Shimi ben Gera, who last we saw him was cursing David out and throwing rocks at him. Shimi was following the same exact mistake of Shaul, where he was imagining that what he wanted was what Hashem wanted. So he sees David being punished, and he assumes that David is being punished for usurping the throne of Shaul, which was incorrect. But Shimi ben Gera comes, the Elef Ish Imo mi Binyamin. So he comes at the head of 1,000 men from Binyamin. Why? The Rishon points out it's obvious what Shimi's trying to do. He realizes he's in big trouble, but he wants to save himself by showing David that I am not just the individual Shimi ben Gera. I am a very important leader person. I am a political leader in Shevet Binyamin. The Navi told us he was from the family of Shaul HaMelech. And if you forgive me, you can get Binyamin back on your side as well. Right? So just like David was forgiving to Amasa to get Yehuda back on his side, so too, Shimi hopes that David is going to be forgiving towards him to get Shevet Binyamin back on his side. And sure enough, that's exactly how it works. He runs forward towards the king. He's there earlier than anybody except for Shevet Yehuda. He says, let's forget. Let's not remember. Bygones be bygones, and I was throwing rocks to you and cursing you out. I know I sin. Now I'm doing tshuva. Happens to be that is the best possible way, you know, to get David to forgive you. You know, anybody out there who is more understanding of somebody who says ani chatasi, right, than David HaMelech himself, and that works. Now we get the other side of the coin. Right? The Navi gives us the La'ava es Sonecha perspective. This time not from Yoav ben Tzruya, but from his brother Avishai. Avishai ben Tzruya, who says, what? Right? How could he not be killed? Ki leil es Mashiach Hashem. He cursed Hashem's anointed. Right? And David says, no. David says, you b'nei Tzruya. He puts Avishai and Yoav together, the sons of Tzruya. No. Right? This is not going to be a day, you must ish be Israel. Today is not going to be a day when people are going to be executed, and the king swears lo sumus ve'shavah lo hamelech. Right? So once again, this is the third time. Avshalom was one, Amasa was two, and Shimi is three, where David is trying to pursue a conciliatory course towards his enemies. And in this case, the third case, the implication is pretty clear that the Navi endorses what David does over here. Right? So it's complicated. For Avshalom, Yoav was clearly correct. For Shimi, the Navi pretty clearly thinks that David was correct. And Amasa is very complicated. Now, there's one piece we need to appreciate that Avishai is up to over here. It's not a coincidence that Avishai described David as the Mashiach Hashem. Right? He cursed Hashem's anointed. Because what was the previous episode that Avishai and David had? The very first moment of Avishai's career, I think, that we saw was when Avishai and David snuck up on a sleeping Shaul and his whole camp. Avishai realizes that this is clearly miraculous. This is clearly supernatural. And Avishai imports his desire, right? He reads his desire into what Hashem is doing. Really very similar, ironically, to what Shimi himself did, right? Shimi correctly realized that David was being punished, but he assumed that he was being punished for usurping Shaul. Avishai sees Shaul sleeping, and he assumes, Hashem is doing it to allow David the opportunity to assassinate Shaul, which is what Avishai himself wants to do. See, Gar Elokim Hayom Es Aivacha B'Yadecha, right? It is such a pattern in Sefer Shmuel. You know, Hashkacha is always there, but figuring out, you know, what Hashem actually wants and isolating that from what you want, very, very hard to do. Fundamental piece we have in all the Pesukim over here. So Avishai wanted to kill Shaul, right? This is the original time. What did David say to Avishai? Al tashchiseo ki mi shalach yado Mashiach Hashem benika. No one's touching the Hashem's anointed. And Avishai didn't like it. So Avishai, like, you know, gives David like a dumbfounded stare. And so David talks again. Chai Hashem, right? He swears no one's going to touch him. Chalilu me Hashem, Mishloach Edi v'Mashiach Hashem. Nobody touches Hashem's anointed. Avishai, you need to respect. Shaul may be my enemy, but anybody who Hashem anointed as the king of Bnei Yisrael has to be treated with reverence. That is what David said to Avishai many, many years ago. Right. So what happens now? This is just fantastic. Avishai comes back to David. And Avishai says, David, I am going to use your words against you. Where is the respect for the Mashiach Hashem? I thought we venerate the person who is anointed as the king of Bnei Yisrael. And now you're telling me that the man who curses and throws rocks at the Mashiach Hashem should just be forgiven? I thought that's exactly what you told me all those prakim ago. You know, hear where Avishai is coming from. And David tells him, I don't care. I am not going to do it. You know, I'm forgiving my kavod because this is not a day where people should die. This is a day to bring people together. So, okay, that's the third case. Now we have the last one here, especially in light of everything else, especially in light of how David bends over backwards for Avshalom and for Amasa and for Shimi ben Gera, we can understand why Chazal look at the next few psukim as the greatest mistake and the greatest disaster in David HaMelech's entire life. Mephibosheth ben Shaul yarad l'kras hamelech. This is like out of nowhere. We've had kings and generals and leaders, and now we have a cripple. Mephibosheth ben Shaul yarad l'kras hamelech, b'lo asa raglav, b'lo asa snow. Right, he hadn't dressed, he hadn't shaved. Min hayom lechas hamelech ad yom asher ba b'shalom. So he looks as pitiable and as pathetic as somebody could look, right? Shimon ben Gera came in ago, trying to look as impressive as possible, the head of 1,000 men. Now Mephibosheth, just a pathetic sight, right? So David says, why didn't you come to Mephibosheth? Mephibosheth says, I was deceived by my Eved, right? Because Tziva deceived me, and I told him to pack my stuff so I could travel with you, and then instead he galloped off and joined you and left me behind. We discussed a couple of prakam ago, the treason of Tziva. And then Mephibosheth like goes on and on and on for a number of psukim. Just, it's like, he's like, crushingly righteous over here, right? I don't need anything. You know, you're Adoni Kemelech, Hamelech Kemelech Elokim, Aseh Tov Beinecha. You took all my money, but it doesn't matter. I don't care. You know, I'm lucky I'm alive. My father's whole house should have been killed anyway. And you did this amazing chesed of inviting me to your palace. Mal Yeshli Odes Dakav Lezokbo Del Melech. I have nothing else to ask for, right? It's like, You are overwhelmed by the tzidkus of Mephibosheth. And yet, somehow, despite being forgiving to Avshalom and forgiving to Amasa and forgiving to all of his enemies, we see, in a sense, Yoav's prophecy come true. After being forgiving to all of his enemies, what happens to David here? He is unforgiving to the one person in the whole story who's his friend, right? He fired Yoav, both of you. He fires Yoav, he fires his general. Now he turns to Mephibosheth and he says, "Lama tadaber od debarecha amarti atav tzivat techalku es hasadeh." Split it, right? Split it. Mephibosheth just says he can take everything. Asher ba adini amelech b'shalom b'so. I don't care. You're home. Everything's great, right? So, but David says split, and it's really, really, it's crushing, right? David, he is indeed. We can say that if we took a look at the whole parak. Indeed, Yoav's criticism can be correct. We see he's turning on his friends, even as he is supporting his enemies. And the Gemara in Shabbos says that this is really the key moment for David HaMelech. Amar Rav Yehuda Marav, Veshash Amar David Mephibosheth, Atav Atzivat Techalku Es Hasada, Yetz the Baskel Ba'amra Lo, Rechavam Be'erav Michalku Es Hamalucha. This is the moment where the splitting of the kingdom is decreed. If David had not taken Lashon Hara here, what was the disaster that comes from this? The kingdom is ruptured. Right, all the 10 tribes worshiping Avodah Zarah for all Sefer Malachim. This ultimately leads to the Galus. It all comes from this moment. And I think we can also add that compounding the mistake of David what makes this one stand out from everything else, right? There are other times that David has done something wrong. But this is the first time and the only time where David has a second chance and David blows the second chance, right? David did not, he's not losing the kingdom because of the initial time when Tziva comes and deceives David and David gives the entire property to Tziva. What makes this so terrible, I think, is that David gets a second chance, right? He hears the response from Mephibosheth. He now can right the wrong. And the first and the only time David fails to take advantage of that opportunity, he fails to fully take advantage of that opportunity, he splits the estate instead of listening to Mephibosheth forgiving him and giving it all back to him. And the Malbim points out that this line of the Gemara is already hinted at, and we'll see this very clearly next week, in the continuation of the Pesukim. The Malbim says it's not a coincidence that what happens immediately after the David punishing Mephibosheth, the rebellion of the Malbim says. That's what I'm thinking. Wishful thinking, maybe. What was the Malbim? L'chein esmach in Mephibosheth l'inyin shimi kisham nasa pesha hamreid makel malko v'po hashim l'ishlamo brish shalok mishpat. Right, so Lavin points out the irony that David is forgiving the rebel while he is convicting the person who supports him. Right, so okay, the last few psukim, David is very supportive to his friend. Again, it's not all bad. Right, Barzilai Agiladi was one of David's three major supporters outside the Jordan River. So the Navi says that David was extremely generous to him, and we don't really need to go into the details. Right, but so the bottom line, we take a step back and we look at this whole limud. Right. And Yoav ben Tzruya has a point. David also has a point, right? He's correct to forgive Shimi ben Gera. He may well be correct to forgive Amasa. He was wrong to forgive Avshalom or to try to save him. When it comes to the basic question of the hawk versus the dove, well, it's hard. It's complicated. The answer is that both perspectives need to be really taken into consideration seriously, and every individual situation calls for its own approach. But when you do lean too hard and too exclusively in one direction, that invariably is going to cause problems, right? Yoav leaning so hard on the hawkish direction caused problems before with the assassination of Avner, which was a disaster, and David leaning so hard on the dovish direction is causing problems here, with almost leading to destruction with Avshalom. And then we'll look next week at how the next rebellion is going to take place. Okay, so I'll stop there. If anyone has any questions, I'll talk about it. Otherwise, looking forward to next time.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. Okay, have a great Shabbos, everybody.